place is different. Special. The others don't want to talk about it because it scares them. But we all know it. We all feel it. Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Brought here. And who brought us here, Jeff?
The island.
Two players, two sides. One is light, one is dark.
I see you in another life, brother. We have to go back!
Hello and welcome to The Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and on my broken music box plays A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes.
My name is Joanna Robinson. Rather than pick the one of the worst Disney songs ever, I decided to pick Clair de Lune by Claude Debussy because I am a basic bitch.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I am in my music box that needs a fixin'. I would have the track Nobody Speak by DJ Shadow featuring Run the Jewels, because the opening of that song is really a personal anthem of mine. And that's what I would want to have a small ballerina dancing to in a box.
The ballerina dancing to Nobody Speak really puts the icing on top of that cake. We are making Music Box references because we are here to talk about Season 1, Episode 9 of Lost, Solitary. This is your first time joining us. Interesting choice to jump in on. But we're doing a Lost Rewatch podcast. Each episode is split into two parts. One part we call The Calm and has nothing besides the episodes we've watched for this podcast so far. That would be the pilot through Episode 9, Solitary. Then we jump into what we call The Storm, where we get to use all the knowledge accumulated since Lost ended to talk about basically Season 1, Episode 9. Solitary. But this one especially has a little bit of lore introduced, so the storm will have some meat on those bones, those storm bones. Great pivot, Dave. Joanna, do we have any reviews this week?
We might. You really don't want to take the bait on that being the worst Disney song ever? This is the inside joke, if you haven't listened to this podcast before, is that Dave Gonzalez insists that A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes is A, the best, B, the most quintessential. I don't know. We've had a lot of different debates about Disney songs. And this is the one that Dave has hitched his wagon to. And I just think it's incorrect. That's all. No?
Yeah, well, for those who've been following our long, argument about A Dream is a Wish Your Heart Makes, if you listen to our concluding episode to the Storm of Spoilers podcast, where we were live in San Francisco, I start with a song, and the first slide is, "You dream of spring, Robin Aaron," which is, "A dream is a wish your heart makes." So there's an Easter egg for you. You love that song because you love the best Disney song, "A dream is a wish your heart makes." Joanna, do we have any reviews?
You incepted me with a Robin Aaron song? Like, how fucking dare you, actually? Did I stall long enough to pull up iTunes and pull up our reviews? I sure did. Great job, Joanna. All right. So do we have some reviews? We do. Thank you so much, everyone, for writing in. One star. Geez, Joanna and guest giggling like teenagers, and please get rid of the droning thank yous to your patrons. Oh, so getting rid of the small council and laughter. No. Thank you, SF Homeless Guy, for that review. Okay. And then we will pick another one. This one is from Cast 14 PSU. And Cass says, I found your podcast just before season 8 started, and I'm so bummed it took me so long. I love being spoiled by the storm, and your thoughts and commentary helped me survive my 1.5 to 2-hour commute. I am grateful for the Lost rewatch because not only does it fill the void during my drive, it also gives me some new appointment TV. I have 2 small children, 2 and 5, and having a show that is mommy's keeps me from going through the endless loops of kid programming. I was a fan of Lost during its initial run, but tuned out at some point. I caught bits and pieces of the final season, but can't remember how I felt about it. Thank you again for your work during Game of Thrones. I still enjoy listening to older shows while I wait for new episodes, and thanks for digging into Lost. So that is from Cass14PSU. So glad you have that. So yeah, and to recap, no laughter is staying, and as is our thank yous to our small council. Those are our reviews.
Excellent. If you leave us a review on iTunes, if you give us 5 stars, you still cannot get rid of the small council names.
Our guest this week to talk about Solitary is our friend Manu Mishra. And yeah, he's here to talk about, you know, the fact that Naveen Andrews is an Indian man playing an Iraqi and how we feel about that. So we will get to all of that later in this episode.
It's going to be great, and hopefully there's, I don't know if the subject matter for giggling, but we welcome giggling wherever we could get it on this serious show about people on an island like a certain Hurley does this episode. Oh, we're going to get there, because first, we have to hear from you, our listeners, via our co-host, Neil Miller, in his segment, Found Signals.
Yes, guys, very exciting news. In the Found Signals, we have a new email address that you can use to contact your faithful hosts. It is hosts, H-O-S-T-S, at stormpodcast.com. Stormpodcast.com, our new website, put together by our producer, Diana, who's doing just fantastic work. And you should also know, if you have us, you know, saved in your contacts as stormofspoilers@gmail.com, you can still use that one. It gets forward to the new one. But, you know, we're trying this new thing. We got at Storm Podcast on Twitter now, which very exciting. You will notice that you're following it if you were following us before, because we just changed it. And, the new website, which we're very excited about. All right. Let's get to, the Found Signal of the week. Remember, I was asking for stories about how you came to Lost. This one, really great email from Heather in Salt Lake City. Heather says, I'm a bit older than you guys and most of your listeners who have sent in their Lost origin stories so far. I was in my early 30s when Lost premiered. I saw ads for it, so I checked out the pilot when it aired less than 24 hours before I got on a plane to Hawaii. Ooh, the timing. Since I was there for over a week, I was able to watch the second episode from the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Needless to say, I was a little nervous to take that flight home to LAX. I was hooked from the beginning and started hooking my friends in, first with VHS tapes of the live show, then inviting them over when I got TiVo. Oh, remember TiVo?
Doop, doop.
Our parties grew each week with more and more fans gathering at my house. They turned into elaborate affairs with snacks and drinks and sometimes full feasts. Over the 6 seasons, many friendships and even love matches happened and grew on those Wednesday nights. We listened to podcasts, read up on theories, and we would discuss and speculate before and after every show. For the finale, we had a costume party and jammed almost 30 people into my 10 by 20 foot living room. We've tried to recreate those parties with other shows and movie nights, but nothing has captured the magic. Lost taught me that a TV show could be consuming and reminded me how to critically think and analyze, skills I had lost since graduating college. It changed how I watch TV ever after, and I will always be grateful for all the joy it brought to my life and my group of misfit friends. Thank you very much, Heather, for your wonderful email.
I love that email from Heather. Can I add a note from a listener, Ben, who emailed in? Just a real quick one.
Sure.
Yes, yes, but then I want to loop back for a Heather-related question. But Ben, away.
No, why don't you hit Heather's question? Do it.
All right, did you guys have, like, television shows that you had these sorts of, like, party, like, friendship experiences with?
Yeah, Lost.
Yeah, Buffy.
Yeah, okay, because I had like Sopranos into like 24, like sort of era.
Sopranos, wow.
Wow.
Well, Sopranos. Just for the last, it was for the last season of The Sopranos that we all sort of like got together. And then like after that, we're like, what do we want to do? And it became 24 because we were near a bar that would give shots every time Jack Bauer killed a person. Anyway, let's hear from Ben.
Oh, well, Ben just wrote us in a lovely, nice, positive email, but he was like, hey, can you remember to include some positives when you hit some negatives in the episodes? And I think that that's like kind of a fair thing to say, which is that, like, of course we love Lost. Otherwise, we would not be doing a podcast about it. But I think this is a little different from our Game of Thrones thing because, like, we consider our love of Lost or our love of an individual episode to be sort of a given, whereas Game of Thrones, we were like, do we love this episode? We're not sure, sort of thing. And so, you know, it's easy to be like, oh, I forgot about this very silly or kind of stupid thing that they did in this episode. But I'm going to do a better job of trying to remember, like, the moments that I love, like, in previous recent episodes we watched and discussed, like the peanut butter or the kiss. Like, there are things that we've talked about, but like, I'll make sure to do a little better job of hitting the things I love while also making fun of 2004.
Well, that might be some moth kickback, I think. But that also was notable for being the first episode in our rewatch that I felt didn't live up to my memory of rewatching Lost, but I think thus far, you know, we're back into what I enjoy about the show, which is a little bit of mystery mixed in with our flashback structure. Let's kick it off with a solitary for the calm. Neil, what happened this week on Lost?
Well, we're talking about Solitary, which is directed by Greg Yatanis. I don't know how that is supposed to be pronounced. That's a preview for the small council names. It's written by David Fury, cinematography by Larry Fong, which Larry Fong did not shoot a ton of episodes on Lost. He did the pilot, obviously. So it's always nice to call out when we get him back. Lots of very intimate shots in this one. Anyway, let's talk about the plot. Let's talk about what happened on the island. First, Saeed finds a cable in the jungle, follows it into the jungle, and then gets knocked out from behind. Second time in like 3 weeks that Saeed has been conked on the head.
Just knocked out, yeah.
Just a tough, tough stretch for our guy. Elsewhere, Locke has a new hunting buddy named Ethan. That's pretty much all we're going to say about that for now. The survivors are also beginning to get a little bit stir crazy, and we're meeting some of the other people that were part of the 40. How many are left at this point? 42?
47? 40.
46? Minus a Joanna? I don't know. The 40-ish people that are still alive and survived. Elsewhere, Saeed, we find him being tortured by the French woman, which is some immediate payback for what he did to Sawyer last week. We learn that the French woman's name is Danielle Rousseau, and she initially thinks that Saeed is one of the quote-unquote others, which she talks about quite a bit. Even though we're not sure what that means yet, it's, you know, fairly ominous. Back in the camp, Hurley builds a golf course, which is just awesome, because for a fleeting moment, the survivors have some fun and relax and feel safe in a way that Jack could not make them. Anyway, we also learn that Michael was not only in construction, but he was an artist in a past life, and he had not yet heard about the freaking polar bears. which is evidence of how information is not flowing to everyone. Later, Rousseau tells a very harrowing story about her science team and how they all got sick and died or were killed by her. And Saeed comes to the conclusion that she's been alone for way too long. Saeed then escapes from Rousseau with his own heartfelt live together, die alone speech, and then heads back to the jungle where, and I can't stress this enough, he hears whispers. Exactly. In flashbacks, we see a scene where Saeed begins the scene speaking in Arabic and torturing a man. And then after the camera moves around this man, everyone in the room starts speaking English because 2004 audiences, I guess. We explore then some Saeed's time in the Iraqi Republican Guard and set up his friendship with his superior officer. And then we meet Nadia, whose name really is Noor, but no one calls her Noor. We know that. In the end, Saeed betrays his country, his friend, all to save Nadia, but not before she writes him a lovely note and he shoots himself in the leg. So that's how he got the bullet wound. The whole thing ends with Sawyer sort of making nice with the group based on some gambling, mutual love of gambling on golf. Walt, after being forgotten by his father, asks Locke to teach him how to throw knives, which I'm sure will go well. And again, Saeed hears whispers, which
whispers
seems important. So that's what happened this week on Lost.
This week on Lost. Okay.
Did you? We did not mention really quickly who plays Ethan, which is William Mapother. It's Tom Cruise's cousin.
He's Tom Cruise's cousin?
Oh, yeah. I could see it now that you've said it, but I did not know anything about it until seconds ago.
Tom Cruise's real name is Tom Mapother. Cruise, believe it or not, is a screen name.
What?
When I told Diana that when we were watching, she's like, oh, bless. Like, someone else got all the, and like, no, but you can see it. It's there. And like sort of the way that the brow furrows over the nose, it's there. The Mapother line. Anyway, welcome Tom Cruise's cousin to the island. This is an episode of Lost. Dave, what should we talk about?
Well, I mean, I think we need to, we have a little bit of a time jump. First of all, I went back, checked the notes. We have 46 people still alive. Saeed is up the coast, and we're on day like 12, I think, according to our Lostpedia. So we're getting up there in days. And some things have been happening on the island as Saeed has been, you know, trying to map out the coast. Originally, this episode and the next episode, which is a Claire episode, which isn't a spoiler as we've discussed, to mention that. We're switched, but because of some plot things that happen next week that we won't talk about, this episode had to come first. So I'm not exactly sure when in the writing process, like definitely there were drafts after the episodes were switched, even though the production episode numbers remain, where this is, I believe, numbered as like episode 107. Whereas the Claire episode is 106, pilots 100. It's not important. But I do think it's interesting how some of those are weaved together, especially with this like little time jump. But the reason supposedly they switched those back, according, to, I think a podcast about Lost at the time, was it would have seemed weird giving the drama that is going to happen next week to have Hurley build a golf course. And have, you know, sort of some friendly things happening. So it benefited to have not only this come after Confidence Man, where Saeed has gone back on some sort of promise he's made to himself. Do we get to see maybe why he gave up torturing? But it gives us like some time to have this delightful Hurley B plot, while, you know, before we really amp up the tension again with some stress on our poor survivors. Right now, their only stress is like, being bored in the caves and only having boar to eat, which doesn't seem that bad in comparison.
And getting hives.
Getting hives. Stress-related hives. And taking up poor Jack's time, which Sawyer nickname watch is Dr. Quinn.
Yes. Which is in the running for most 2004 thing, even though that's a late 90s thing, but it still feels...
Like just not offensive, so we're stepping in the right direction. It's like name watch.
The best one yet, maybe. Well, Freckles, it's like this and Freckles are the only two like non-problematic ones that Sawyers has come up with. So. Except Dr. Quinn was a girl. Anyway.
Also, one of the better Sawyer one, like just like Sawyer quips, is when he says the whole doctor playing golf thing. It's like one of the more endearing Sawyer shitty moments.
Is this where I get to talk about political philosophy?
Sure.
Does that have to do with the Gulf?
No. We can talk about
Gulf. Oh, okay. No, let's talk about political philosophy.
Well, we got dinged in a previous episode for not being like John Locke. You know, like John Locke. So maybe we should talk about why Daniel Rousseau is named Rousseau. Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He's a French philosopher. His most famous work is The Social Contract, where he talks about how no one has the divine right to rule, that the rules for society should come from the will of the people, not the will of the, like, the monarchy and or the rich. His most famous idea from this piece is man is born free, but he is everywhere in chains, which is a nice little notion for an episode that involves both Said and Nadia being prisoners. I don't know. Anyways, yeah, so Rousseau is a champion of the common person. I don't know that this applies directly to our character Danielle, but nor does Locke's philosophy sort of align with that character. But just this idea of them, they'll introduce more and more of these political philosophers. But this idea, as we continue to talk about what makes a society work, what makes this microcosm of society work on the island, and this idea that we'll revisit in season one and going forward of, like, who gets to lead these people? Like, who gets to decide who knows that there's a polar bear? Because, like, Michael doesn't know, because they're definitely not a democracy on that beach. There are the rulers, which are our named characters, and then there's everyone else who, as far as I can see, is, like, fetching firewood and hanging out. So, just keeping that Rousseau of it all in mind.
Definitely. And I mean, I think I also want to now loop back to Gulp after that, up of what you said, because this is the first time that Hurley really takes assertive leadership.
Yeah.
Which is something the character will continue doing until he becomes part of, like, somebody who the ruling council respects his opinion. Right now, Hurley has a lot of comments, and then I'm not sure what happened last week when his comment about, you know, Jack being like a Jedi immediately led to Jack, like, doing the un-Jedi thing and trying to, like, punch Sawyer. So, it's nice to see him elevated in, like, a confident character level, where this is the Hurley that I remember from having rewatched the show before. The guy who knows the value of, like, fun and keeping a level head while everybody else, Michael's doing an okay job figuring out how to separate shower water from drinking water, but he's still being like a bad son, father to Walt, when he could have just, you know, let Walt take his golf swing for him.
Oh man, that's one of the most frustrating things about this episode.
So annoying.
It's like, bro, you could have made it all work out just fine if you'd just been like, take my shot, son.
I was like, it's right there.
Who I keep forgetting about.
It's, but then I get angry when he tries to spend time with Locke. Like, it was just right there. And as if, like, anyone watching would have objected to the, like, one kid on the island having a swing. Like, it was very aggravating. Yeah.
Hives guy might have. Yeah. Be like, wait a minute.
I even think Hives guy would have been pretty chilled about it.
Even Hives guy's like, oh, Walt's so cute in his oversized shirts. So the thing that I want to say about Hurley, and this goes to my comment last week, I think, about, like, dignity for Hurley, is, like, what's prized about Hurley, what he has to contribute is emotional intelligence, which I think is a really cool, thing to be a valued aspect of a member of society. You know what I mean? Like, Jin can fish and Locke can hunt boar. Jack can fix things sometimes, but, like, you know.
Kate can climb trees.
She sure can, but Hurley, you know, he understands when people need a morale boost, and that's an important part of leadership. So, you know.
I like the golf storyline. I like the levity of it, because the rest of the episode, I think, is a ponderous look at two people who have a lot of trauma in their lives and have been very, very lonely for maybe self-imposed reasons. Said happens across a cable. Don't worry about that right now, because it leads him to traps. And then he wakes up in a dugout tent with Rousseau that, you know, doesn't have any electricity that it looks like that cable would run to. So we're just going to put it out of our mind and stick with Rousseau, who has been around for a while and is looking for Alex, her child.
I know that we knew that there had been someone on the island because we had heard this like French woman's transmission before, but like this is such a big deal, right? Because it's like there's someone else on this fucking island. Well,
presumably she was dead because the broadcast had been going for 16 years.
I know, but no.
At the time that we heard it, we were like, oh, these poor plane crash survivors aren't going to last a week. But then they did, and then they got horny, and then, you know, they kind of willed their way through it. Built themselves a golf course.
This really is the first
made it
proof.
Run. Yeah.
Yeah, this is the first proof that there's anyone else on this island.
And according to her, there are others, so that's fun.
Right. She's been in the sun for a very long time.
She really has.
So we're not, and I do like that. I like that the show sort of plays with the, you know, what is true and what is not true, or what can we really believe from Rousseau? Because she's so unreliable as a narrator of even her own story. Because even in this episode, she goes from saying like, oh, they all got sick and died, to at the end of the episode, we realize that she maybe killed them or killed some of them because she thought they were sick.
At least killed the one that she loved the
most. At least killed her favorite.
It's been, it's good to see Rousseau, but it's very sad and not encouraging from a survival standpoint that, she says there's others, but she's never seen others. And it's very obvious from her behavior and Saeed's reaction to it that he thinks she's just been alone this whole time, living off of bear and boar and whatever, supply she could scavenge, because all she's got, all the evidence she's got are the whispers. She doesn't even seem to think that a monster exists, that it's all been just bears. Saeed at this point also has not seen the monster. Locke's the only one. Locke and Kate are the only ones that have seen something off screen, with the clicking and the hissing and the trees falling.
This is the episode. This is the moment of my life where I found out that rifles have bolts in them. I don't know.
Nice.
Or firing pins.
Yeah, this is the thing. Doesn't she say she took the bolts out of the rifles? I thought that's what she said. Maybe she took said firing pin. Whatever it is, Rousseau, she's one step. She might be a little loopy, but she's one step ahead of you. That's for sure.
She's got one trick. It's just one trick that works.
Yeah, but it's worked all time. So there you go. Yeah.
It's interesting that she's presented as like this sort of, survivor, once very intelligent and part of a research team, obviously like still knows how to ask for, Alex in multiple languages. And then the episode allows you to think that maybe she's a little more unhinged than that. Like she loves the music box, and Saeed is like worried about her hearing whispers in the jungle. And then, oh, she removed the firing pin. Like she didn't just leave a guy there with a rifle as she chased after a bear. So the ongoing question of how much Rousseau's story lines up with reality is a very nice hat tip, to the mysteries of the island without blowing them open, which is something they almost did a little bit more, but we'll have to address that in the storm.
Maybe I learned what bolts are from the film The Hunt for the Wilder People, where they take the bolts out of people's guns a lot. Who knows? But somewhere along the way, because I have only ever touched a gun once in my life and I really hated it, and a cop actually made me do it. I do not touch guns, so I know very little about them.
I think it's the firing pin. I'm going back through my notes now.
That sounds right.
That would make more sense. It would make more sense to me because in order to like
you
load
would, like,
a
know,
rifle, you would have
know
to pull the bolt.
Yeah, you would notice the bolt's gone. I get it.
You would,
I get
like,
it.
See it.
I get it.
Again, I've only shot rifles for the Boy Scouts, so that's again.
What's
way
his
back.
Name? Didn't notice either.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he'd been electrocuted on a metal bed for and tied up for a little while and drugged with like a. Did she just rub that needle against like a cloth for a little bit to sterilize it before that, knocking out Saeed?
That counts. It counts. By what's his name? You met Robert, right? You didn't mean Saeed.
Robert.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always forget Rousseau's man, the booty call that she killed. Or her husband? I don't remember what they are. It doesn't matter yet.
Should she not have referred to him as Robert instead of Robert? I don't know. I think Robert in French is Robert.
But was he French? I don't remember.
Who knows? If we'll ever know. This might be the last time we ever see Danielle. yes. Shall we talk about the flashback? Can we talk about the language thing?
Please do. It's one of the all-time funny. This has to be in contention for most 2004 thing, because you know that they did this, not just because Naveen Andrews speaking Arabic is not great, but I think because the audience.
Maybe, but like they had no. Okay, so, you know, as we established, instead of like with Sun and Jin's stories, you get a lot of people speaking Korean and it's subtitled and it's fine. In this, we get Naveen Andrews speaking Arabic for like a hot 2 seconds and then the camera pans around someone's head and then all of a sudden everyone in the room is speaking English.
They switched on the translator chip.
Oh, they put their babblefish in their ear. But
they did a 13th Warrior. I wanted to play.
I was watching my roommate Diana. Here's a drink for roommate Diana stories. But like, I was watching with Diana, who was watching for the first time. We'd just been talking about Daniel Dae Kim's like sort of dodgy Korean accent. And, Diana knows Arabic because she studied in Egypt for a while. And she was like, I was like, oh, okay, tell me how Naveen Andrews' accent is. Like, let's find out. Cause this dude is British born Indian. So is his Arabic actually good? And he starts talking. She's like, oh, you know how I know it's bad? I can understand it. She's like, it's super slow. So I can understand it. And that means it's like labored. And so I bet Naveen was just like, guess what? I'm not doing this. I mean, maybe they did it because like they thought audiences or white audiences or whatever, like didn't want to hear Arabic spoken for a prolonged period of time. But I think it has more to do with the fact that Naveen Andrews is like, I can do two lines.
It's probably half and half. And then, you know, you throw it to the room of writers and you're like, well, nobody in Saeed's story needs to be keeping a secret about whether or not they could speak multiple languages. So let's let the studio win this one and not be the show in 2004 that does an entire Arabic episode.
What did 24 do? Because I never watched 24.
24, I think, had some subtitles, but mostly because it was like they were on when we did meet Arabic characters, they were usually in America. Okay. We would usually see them, you know, speak mostly English. It was definitely subtitles were used for otherism on 24, if that makes sense, from like a story context. If you needed it to be like really bad guys who were not supposed to be there, you could subtitle them or just have them speaking nonsense, right? Because it's 24.
It's an othering sort of thing. Yeah.
Right. It's not about like a story point or anything like that. It's,
Whereas with Lost, it's clear that they gave up on it about 10 seconds into it.
And they're like, you know what? Let's just lean into this. And much like that, another good reason to bring up 13th Warrior is because Antonio Banderas is playing an Arabic man in that. So might as well, you know, get him up with the Vikings and have them all speaking English as soon as possible. Because that's like, you know, dodge issues of race by panning behind a head and the crossfading sound to the language of your choice. It's always English. Crossfading to English.
It's fine. Who am I to say it's fine? But like, this is how I always feel about like accents in film. And TV is like, I'm like, just have them use their natural accent. If they can't do the accent, don't worry about it. Like, yeah. It's fine. You know what I mean? Like, I kind of wish they had just made Peter Dinklage use an American accent for Tyrion. That's how I feel about it.
But a little more to Neil's side of most 2004 thing. Apparently, one of the drafts of the script had Nadia saying that Saeed was a traitor for working for Saddam Hussein. That was not allowed in the final script. We do not get a Saddam Hussein name drop. It's just, you know, he's part of the Iraqi Republican Guard. We knew that already, but we don't need to hit that home too much. We don't need to actually see him torture people. Again, contemporary show with 24. But this Lost goes torture light, I think, in comparison to last week, at least. But kind of goes for the heart, having Nadia described all the previous ways that she's already been tortured to Saeed, and sort of saving the cruel realities of being tortured for an emotional moment, which, as far as television goes, and definitely as far as television 2004 goes, I think is played pretty well. This type of love story of, you meet an old friend and you guys are on opposite sides of like a horrible conflict is, pretty well executed here, I think. It's hard to take a strong stance behind it because I know in my mind, more about Saeed's character, especially that he tells at least one lie in this episode. Joanna, did the flashback story work for you, especially since it didn't have a lot of anchors, in the Rousseau storyline?
I don't know. I feel like that this is one of the slightly more like ham-fisted parallels, do you know what I mean? Like, the torturer becomes the tortured or something like that. And yeah, so I don't know. I mean, I like the Nadia stuff. There is some like, we never see him like, he never harms her. He like slightly interrogates her, but he doesn't like harm her.
But it's inferred that he does.
Yeah, that he tortured her off screen.
Right.
So that's problematic from any point of view. You know what I mean? It's like that this is like some kind of love story, but like he tortured her. I don't know. That's the thing to think about.
Yeah, I think the show wants us to focus more on this parallel that sort of runs through both the A and B stories, like the Hurley B story and all of the things they're trying to say about Saeed, which is the things that we hold on to in isolation. So like in Nadia's world, she ends up being very fond of the chats that she and Saeed have, even though it involves torture. Like that's a thing that she's holding on to at what she believes to be pretty much the end. Same thing with Rousseau and the music box, and then the other islanders and just this one fun thing that they get to do.
All right. Yes. You talked me into it, Neil. I like the flashbacks.
So I think that's what the show would rather us focus on, because there is like when we're too into the torture part, there's a lot of mixed up stuff. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's not great. Like the inference that Saeed is torturing, Nadia off screen, the sort of intimate way in which they shoot to the parts where Rousseau is torturing Saeed to sort of create confusion, but also show some of the pain that he's experiencing. I think the show would rather us focus on like the part where it's all about what we hold on to in these terrible moments rather than the terrible moments which are happening to these characters.
I mean, that's a good enough excuse for me, even, I guess, if it doesn't work, because those are, you know, three pegs to hang your hat on. I like it.
Everyone knows you need three pegs to hang
gotta
your hat on.
Gotta have the three pegs.
Yep. Gotta have a lot of hats.
Dave's got a lot of big hats.
Okay. Most 2004 thing about this episode.
And most 2004 thing.
This is to make up for the fact that I didn't use this as the most 2004 thing of Confidence Man, which a lot of people were hoping I had, which is that torture as a main plot, is that the most 2004 thing? Is the most 2004 thing, as we mentioned, the switch from Arabic to English, or is the most 2004 thing the nickname Dr. Quinn, What do you think? What's the most 2004 thing about this episode? I tried to make it not Shannon related this week. It's hard to ignore Shannon when we do this, but you know.
I think it's got to be Dr. Quinn because like that show ended in like 98.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Quinn.
All right.
I think I'm going to go in and say it's the torture. And here's my thought about why it's the torture, because in 2004, you know, we were still in this, you know, you have to kind of put your mind back to where everybody was post 9/11, which is hard because it was a long time ago, but it was in this period of time where torture was happening and it could be pop culturized, like as a thing on an ABC show or as sort of a driving force of a Fox show. It was before we had a big conversation about torture as a country in America. And so it exists in this weird space where it was like, people were kind of not okay with it, but like okay enough for it to be in Lost and be used as a narrative device. And it's just sort of a weird thing to look back and be like, man, we were way too okay with this.
Yeah.
And then later to discover more about what, you know, our government was actually doing is very harrowing. But, yeah, it exists as a very time capsule-y thing. Cause I don't know. I mean, there's plenty of like torture and stuff on different shows, and that, you know, we're not that many years removed from that Jessica Chastain movie that involved a lot of torture.
Zero Dark Thirty.
Yeah, there it is. like we've still, American cinema has continued to use torturing Middle Eastern people as a narrative device, but I think the tone is very different now. You know, like back in 2004, it wasn't like a thing that people talked about, or it wasn't like a huge thing. Whereas like now we got to have a big discussion every time a movie or show uses it. I don't know.
Now I feel like if the conversation in pop culture around torture is you find the debate where your American heroes are debating whether or not to use it. And that becomes like a plot point of the drama,
right?
Which I think is like, you know, now culturally we get to like look back at these things, but this is like the equivalent. You're right. This is like the equivalent of Saeed stumbling upon a child in a cage on some sort of border. If this like aired today, this was them trying to hit something on the head that we were still reckoning with as a country. But then also we hadn't settled on which side we were going to land on yet.
Right. Exactly.
We're so, like, yeah. This could be for everyone's safety, or it could be like a violation of values. Let's see what happens. And it's interesting that, yeah, it comes in the side of mainstream dramas like this, because on one hand, it's presented alongside stuff like Charlie's Story, which is Rockstar gets addicted to drugs, which seems like, you know, kind of a trope, and feels like that now, but I'm not sure, especially with Confidence Man and Solitary being back-to-back, that's what we're doing. I think that is the show reckoning with the national feeling at the time and feeling weird about it. But maybe I'm wrong. I'm not taking this from like any sort of Lost encyclopedia, just from watching a lot of television. Reading the news.
One thing sort of on a slightly sillier letter note is that the gif of Hurley and Charlie on the golf course is like one of the most famous Lost gifts out there.
Oh, they're, one of the all-timers.
It's an all-timer. And there are not enough Lost gifts out there, as I found out this week when like a Sawyer gif I needed did not exist, and it's ridiculous, so I had to make it. And we actually have someone upcoming on the show to talk about Phantom and Lost and how there aren't enough gifts from Lost because
there aren't enough gifts.
Well, there weren't enough gift makers, so you just have to use like the same like Locke smiling with an orange slice in his mouth gif over and over again. Nay,
This sounds like a call to action.
It is a call to arms, my brothers and sisters, gift makers, dream makers, make ye gifts while you may. Anyway, also Hurley's golf course. That's on Kualoa Ranch, which we've talked about before, which is this like location in Oahu where, you know, like some Jurassic Park stuff was filmed, stuff like that. There's a lot of stuff on Kualoa Ranch that was used for for Lost, but if you take the tour, they will take you to a place and they'll be like, and here's Hurley's golf course. So that's like an iconic spot.
It is real pretty.
It's real, real pretty. So, you know,
it's so pretty that they have a shot where Jack and Kate do a walk and talk away from the main group. And the shot is very pretty, but then you realize that Jack and Kate may be standing directly in front of Hurley as he's trying to hit a golf ball, which
Rude.
Is very logistically frustrating for me, because I'm like, oh, Larry Fong, great shot. But then I've played golf before and I've been hit with a golf ball and I'm like, you should not be standing there.
Rude.
That would make the list of irony tropes in the episode on Lostpedia if Jack got hit in the head with a golf ball.
But then Hurley duffs it, so it's like maybe they weren't that worried.
Yeah, he'll get there. He's just got to practice.
Yeah.
What else are they gonna do?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
build showers. build showers, throw Michael, knives, play golf.
Michael used his construction past and his artist past, slammed them together, made showers.
Yeah, that was a weird. Michael's weird in this episode. I guess part of the reason the shower thing exists is there used to be a side plot with Shannon where she caught Vincent drinking out of and bathing in the drinking water, and that got cut out. But
that would be a thing that would bother Shannon specifically.
Yes. Yeah, I think they still left a line in at some point in the caves. You could hear like Shannon go like, "You get him away from the water." But that's what motivates Michael to engineer some showers rather than playing with his son, which he doesn't do. Anyway.
It's like, Michael, what are you doing, man?
I just found some charcoal sets and I was real excited.
You're driving your kid to be a knife thrower.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully that'll come in handy, at least on the island, as much as showerable water will. Is there anything we need to discuss before we talk to Manu?
That's it. Let's do it. Okay, so we are joined by Game of Thrones scenester, Storm of Spoilers listener, a Scene of Ice and Fire podcast hoster, great pun slinger on the at Manuclear Bomb Twitter feed. It is Manu Mishra. Hi, Manu. How are you?
Hey, great, Joe. Thank you for having me on. I'm really excited.
Oh, absolutely. We are thrilled to have you. This is usually when I ask people their, like, how did you start watching Lost story? Manu, do you want to share with the class why you started watching the TV show Lost?
Well, a long, long time ago, about 4 weeks ago, you asked me if I'm starting Lost, and I was kind of like, Game of Thrones just ended, the summer's starting, I feel like I need a break. But then we started talking about some of the, you know, meta commentary around Lost, specifically around the character of Saeed, and that kind of piqued my interest. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to join in on the watch. You know, I'm not going to bypass a chance to be on Storm of Spoilers because I feel like I'm one of the OG listeners. Like, I was
you
there
are.
From day one, and like, this is like, I don't know, an honor to be on with you. So,
right. You're doing this because I forced you to.
Exactly.
Yeah. I guess I want, you know, in that vein, I wanted to ask you, what was your perception of Lost even up to 4 weeks ago before you started watching, versus now? Like, what did you think the show was versus what you're discovering the show to be?
Well, I guess the reason I never dipped into Lost was the same reason I didn't dip into a lot of shows is it's just a lot of episodes and I'm really lazy. But, I had thought I had watched the entire first season back in college just alongside various roommates. It turned out I had watched the first two episodes, cause I thought the first season ended with the polar bear reveal, but nope, that was episode two. it's probably a little more of more mysteries layered on in terms of who else may be on the island, some kind of creatures, these whispers, like there was a lot more mystery than I had anticipated. Cause at this point, it's not quite at a like Westworld level for me, but it's slowly building up to that where it's kind of introducing more questions before it answers, the first ones it asks.
Yeah.
That point is really definitely something I didn't expect, but I do enjoy it. It definitely has me hitting play on the next episode more than I thought I would be originally.
I feel like, and maybe it's impossible to know being, you know, just a fresh new watcher to it. But I feel like when Lost first came out, a lot of people, especially people not familiar with genre storytelling, were like, oh my God, this is so crazy. What's happening? This is insane. I don't know what's happening week to week. All the sort of questions. And now we're a little bit more used to it. So I'm so curious. There's no way exactly for you to know, but how someone who comes to Lost after Westworld or after Mr. Robot or after these various other shows that are trying to sort of emulate Lost, I don't know. I feel like it must be slightly diminished for you because you're like, yeah, this is a mystery show. I know mystery shows.
Yeah. And, I think diminished might be the incorrect word because I do think, I'm a little more prepared for it than, you know, if I hadn't seen Westworld or some of the other shows you mentioned. Yeah. But at times with a show like Westworld, and this is not a Westworld podcast, I swear, I feel like it's a little too much at times.
Yeah.
There's maybe a couple too many balls in the air, where I feel like this one, even though there are a lot of balls in the air and I'm still wondering what's going to happen with some of them, I feel like I can pretty much hold them all in my head at one time and kind of understand where they might be going to, or at least their general trajectories. So I like the level of mystery. It's a comfortable one where I'm never questioning what's actually going on, like in the whole, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's just like, I don't know where certain like specific plot points may land, but I generally still have a feel for it. Whereas something like Westworld, that sometimes I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. I need to read your recaps, just to kind of, you know, square them away. So, I like that, you know, kind of like the stuff that's come out after Lost has kind of prepared me to grapple with how Lost actually is. And I think I might actually be enjoying it more because I'm not like, whoa, what's going on here? I'm like, okay, yeah, I know this is a ball they're throwing up in the air and it might land later this season or into the following season. So I feel more comfortable with it. So I'm actually enjoying it. It's very manageable for me.
Or never. okay. that's a possibility. All right. And then, so we wanted to talk about this character, Saeed, and this idea of Naveen Andrews, British-born Indian, man of Indian descent, playing this Iraqi soldier, putting on this accent, obviously not being able to speak Arabic because they just like really quickly did a thing in this episode where they're like, JK, it's English, all this sort of stuff, and what that looks like now versus what that looked like in 2004. I talked about this a little bit on the main pod, but like I was searching around for articles at the time or throughout the run sort of examining this character Saeed through that lens, and there was really nothing at the time sort of questioning or examining that, because that's not really where the cultural conversation was at the time. The conversation at the time was like, isn't it progressive and cool of us to have this like Iraqi character who like people is largely sympathetic, that is a hero that people are rooting for. Aren't we amazing to have done that? And so I'm just wondering, like, for you watching this starting only with a 2019 perspective, like, what are some of the, like, are there any, like, red flags that pop up for you? Or if there aren't, or if there are you then able to think about it through the 2004 lens and say, like, well, actually, for the time, like, this is kind of regressive? I don't know. Where are you on that spectrum?
Yeah, so it's a lot of complicated thoughts, which is pretty common when you're talking about representation, especially for, like, South Asians or Middle Eastern people who are even maybe less represented than some other marginalized groups in pop culture. So I will say right now that if I was in 2004 watching this, I would be probably fist pumping. It's like, ooh, they actually have a Indian actor on this. Like, I didn't know Apu from The Simpsons was really that bad until the mid-aughts or whatever. I didn't really conceptualize that because at that point, I was still really just thrilled to see someone that looked like me on TV.
Right.
But now I think the conversation has progressed a lot further than that, where I should say I'm of Indian descent. I am not of Iraqi descent.
Right.
And now the concept of casting one type of brown person for a different kind of brown person, that's definitely a bit of Orientalism or otherism, where it's just like, oh, they're interchangeable, or one could be the other, when there's so much difference in the cultures, the languages. That stuff, I don't think aged very well, but I can see why that is a victory lap moment, especially pretty much peak War on Terror 2004,
right,
where, you know, there really isn't much representation. And when it is, it's a lot of like Jack Bauer on 24. And I don't think that, I think season two was the only one that really had the full on brown villain, aspect in it. But either which way, that stuff is the stuff that kind of hasn't aged well. And then I think the part that really doesn't sit well with me, or that I don't love, rather, is that it's still framed through that war on terror, Iraq war right. concept. It's not just like he's an Iraqi person, an Iraqi civilian. It's still in the sense that this is framed through the military aspect, as that's our only relationship to Iraq and their people. And when you add the layer of torture, which we're going to talk about, I'm sure, that also makes it a little grosser, just because Iraqi people were more likely to be the victims of torture from the war on terror and all the stuff we found out about, like, Abu Ghraib and CIA black sites. To take, like, the worst aspects of the whole war on terror culture and to put it all on the brown person seems kind of unfair in retrospect, at least from my point of view.
Yeah. Do you feel like this episode's doing any work to subvert that in terms of, like, not just like in the flashback aspect where we get Saeedi's a torturer, but he's conflicted. There's that. But to have him then he's tortured in this episode. Have him then be tortured by a white woman, basically. Like, is there any sort of like flipping on the head that's happening there?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think it's nice that I think it's valuable that they show, you know, kind of the shoe on the other foot in various different ways here. And one thing I do like about Saeed overall is that he's just a very capable person.
Yes,
And very, in different ways, Indian or brown people, and I know he's supposed to be Iraqi, are portrayed as capable almost always in one way and then incapable in, you know, basically every other way. I mean, you have like the most popular show in the world, The Big Bang Theory, and the one brown character on there can't talk to women unless he's drunk. Like, it's very uncommon to find someone who's like able to get along with other people, who's able to actually do things. And it's not just reduced to like, oh, he's good with computers or something like that. So the fact that he's very capable, I really appreciate that. But then it's also a little bit lessened because that's all his capabilities are kind of coming from his military framing. So
yeah.
It's a lot of give and take with the character, which, you know, like I said, it's kind of very common for how I have to look at brown characters in pop culture overall, because most of them are imperfect in that way.
It's so funny. I literally, just as you were talking about The Big Bang Theory, I was like, Saeed is kind of tech support for the island, but like a lot of other stuff too, but like he still is tech support, so that's that's its own thing.
Yeah, if he was just triangulating the signal, that would be a little right. goofy, but the fact that he's able to do other things and kind of be a leader amongst those people, I think that's a big part, is that he almost before he kind of takes his walk by himself, he's kind of a leader of the beach faction. And if he was just tech support for like Sawyer or God, what's Evangeline Lilly's name?
Oh, Kate. Yeah,
if he was just tech support and one of those other people were just the leader of those group, I think it would sit a lot worse. But the fact that he's actually more than just his like function as a what skills he has, I think that helps a lot.
I like that Saeed is, as you say, this almost rival leader, at least at this point, to Jack. I'm a huge Saeed fan, and I love Naveen Andrews. But the question, you know, the follow question that I then have to ask myself is like, would I want it another way? And it's hard to know, because Naveen Andrews is very good in this role and is like very beloved in this role, and the character is very beloved of Lost fans. And, it's similar to, I was talking to, Lauren Morelli, who was show running the new Tales of the City that they did on Netflix recently. And famously, when that miniseries came out in the early 90s, they had Olympia Dukakis play this iconic trans woman, Anna Madrigal, in the Tales of the City. And Olympia Dukakis is, you know, is a cis woman.
Right.
And she's... that role is iconic. She's iconic in it. She's like the gay community considers her an icon because of her performance in that role. It was like, it's such a huge thing. It's a beloved thing. And then they brought her back for the reboot because like, you don't not bring Olympia Dukakis back to play this iconic trans character that she originated on screen and stuff like that. But when I was talking to Lauren Morelli, I was like, on the one hand, yes, I can't argue against that. On the other hand, I feel like if you were casting this now, there's no way you would cast Olympia Dukakis. And she's like, yeah, you can hold both of those truths. You know what I mean? Like, both of those things can be true. I don't know if you disagree with that.
No, I absolutely do agree with that. I mean, art is inherently messy. And especially when you get into things like this, and it's always going to be a little messier because it's not just art for art's sake. It's part of a large media company and their funding. And, you know, I'm not going to get into a capitalist rant here, but, you know, there's a lot of factors that go into it. And I'm sympathetic to, you know, constraints and, you know, budgets and times and stuff like that. So I think the important thing is to be able to grapple with it and to be honest about it. And knowing that what you could do, it wasn't quite right to do it back in the 90s or to do it with Saeed, you know, in 2004, whenever they started filming, but, at least to understand why it's wrong, but you can still appreciate, you know, what's actually portrayed on screen, how well they grapple with that specifically. Because I'm not pure, even though I, you know, pretend or am super woke or whatever. You know, I still like things that are problematic or things that shouldn't have been cast in a certain way or things that have words that you look back on is like, how did they get away with that? Or why did they use that stuff? You know?
Yeah.
To me, it's always just about being honest with it, but it's not so much because you always want to give people a chance to grow and heal and, you know, give space to expand, you know, and if you just kind of treat it as like an open shut, you kind of lose something, I think, in the process. Always a little bit forgiving as long as the right lessons are learned. And, you know, sometimes they're not, you know, we still have some problems, especially with casting of, say, trans persons in roles and various other ethnic minorities. But, I feel like on the whole, we're definitely getting a lot better than where we were 10, 20, 30 years ago.
Right. And a lot of that is, I think, thanks to exactly what you say, which is like people not having a voice before, having a voice amplified by the internet, sometimes, like I said, for better or for worse, and that helping to push the needle and just saying like, no, we're not going to accept Scarlett Johansson or, right, exactly. You know, whatever, or Emma Stone or whatever it is. All right. So, so let's circle back to this idea of torture as a plot device. In both this episode and the one preceding it, Confidence Man, it's sort of like a twofer, right? It's like Saeed tortures Incompetence Man and he's like, I have to put myself into self-exile because I swore I would never be this person again. And then we get, you know, a better indication of who that person is. We've been talking about this on the main pod, but basically like what they do in this first season is each episode kind of has a tease of what the next episode is going to grapple with. So like you lay the track for the Saeed episode in the Sawyer episode. And then, you know, so he, you know, exiles himself. We get the backstory on his torture practices and the story of Nadia and all this sort of stuff. And then he himself is in turn held captive and tortured. What do you think of that, like, little mini arc, the sympathy that he has for his torture and Danielle Rousseau, and how all of that is conveyed?
Well, it's complicated because obviously, like I mentioned earlier, you know, Iraqi civilians were more likely to be the victims of torture than the perpetrators of it. And then I think you mentioned an interview where it's like, on, you know, another channel, you have Jack Bauer, you know, torturing, you know, brown people. So to see the shoe on the other foot kind of, I don't know if it feels righteous, but it almost like it evens things out a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that, maybe I'm the only one who reads it this way, but the way that he tortures Sawyer with the bamboo shoots, that's, you know, straight out of the Vietnam War and what, you know, they said that the Viet Cong did to American soldiers, which I'm sure is true, but is also probably a little bit embellished by, you know, our pro-US media and news. Okay. So it's like kind of roping that in because, you know, there is no bamboo in Iraq. So it's just like, the extent to which they're like taking like almost a pastiche of torture and like kind of layering it onto Saeed doesn't sit great with me. But I do appreciate that at least Saeed as a character has enough wherewithal or like self awareness to know that what he did was wrong, which, you know, I'd hope that most people would. But, you know, we still torture, you know, to this day. And it's not just military, you know, there's, the Chicago PD got in trouble for it just a couple years ago. So it's really complicated for me because, my empathy and my, you know, my point of view is initially with the brown people who are often the victims of these things. And then, you know, Western media loves to, you know, make them the perpetrators of it or, you know, kind of focus in on them as kind of the center of all that. And it's just something that's never really going to sit great with me, but, just purely from a storytelling aspect, I do think it works nice. Like you were saying, how that led into, like him torturing Sawyer led into the episode, you know, following with, and I forget, the French lady's name.
Danielle Rousseau.
There you go, Rousseau. So I do like that the shoe is kind of on the other foot, even if it feels, I don't want to say ham-fisted, but the fact that it happens like just immediately after in the next episode, it just does feel a little heavy-handed. But I do like that we kind of get Saeed on both sides of it, so it at least kind of fleshes him out a bit, even if I'm not in love with kind of the route they took with it overall.
I think something that feels okay to say, even this early, is the idea that like a lot of these backstories that we get, basically what we'll see on this island is and in any, you know, this is, we've talked about how this is somewhat based on the TV show Survivor. Any survival situation is going to test you, test who you are. And are you like the best version of yourself? Are you the worst version of yourself? Are you going to fall back on like bad patterns of behavior? Are you going to, they talked about this in the episode Tabula Rasa with Kate. Are you going to take a fresh start? What are you going to do? And so like something, you know, it's a choice. You have a choice. And what Lost positions with these flashbacks is like, okay, here's a person at their worst choice that they've made in their life. Or among the worst choices that they've made in their life, with Saeed, it's, you know, to torture people. And then also his sort of one of his better choices, which is to try to break away from that. You know, both of those are contained in his flashback. And then who are you going to be when you come to this island? Are you going to be the guy who like shoves bamboo reeds under, you know, a guy's fingernails? Or, are you going to be someone who offers sympathy and empathy and kindness for this woman who has like abducted you? You know what I mean? And Saeed taking that entire journey in two episodes is kind of one of the miracles of Lost, I think.
Yeah. It actually, it's almost a metaphor the way that, you know, Saeed was trying to triangulate the signal a couple episodes ago. You see that with his character and also a bit with Sawyer's character when you see him kind of at his best and at his worst when, you know, at his best when he walks out on his con, when he sees the little kid.
Right.
In that episode, you kind of lay down two points. This is this character at their best and this is their worst. And this show, this, you know, episode, whatever you want to frame it as, kind of triangulates that and helps you try to figure out who the character is and what direction they're going to be going from here on out. So to that extent, I really like kind of what they're doing, especially with those specific characters, kind of bringing that triangulation metaphor into their arcs as well as just their actual signal searching and all that.
Love it. Love that metaphor. Okay. I know that you have been watching Deadwood, which is an HBO prestige show that a lot of people are revisiting because of the recent movie. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about like any parallels you see between Deadwood and Lost, or what jumps out with you for you watching these two sort of older beloved shows concurrently in 2019.
I think it definitely watching them concurrently. Really emphasize the fact that both of these shows were made in 2004 or thereabouts, just because there was still kind of that strong dichotomy between like prestige drama, you know, with like the HBO shows like The Sopranos and Deadwood versus kind of primetime TV, which like Lost and 24 are kind of the ones I look at.
Right.
And like that line started to get blurred, you know, near the end of the aughts when AMC and FX started really blowing up with Mad Men and Justified and all those shows. But I think you can just see a little more where, to me, Deadwood is almost Shakespearean in its dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot more cocksuckers than William Shakespeare wrote, but like
one or two more.
It's just a lot, you know, the dialogue's very rich, and here in Lost, and I think the dialogue for the most part's pretty good, but you can tell at times where they kind of state the obvious or hold the audience's hand. And I'm sorry that I don't have any specific examples right now, but it was definitely something that just jumped out to me where they would kind of say the subtext or, you know, make it text. Whereas a show that was running concurrently on HBO would kind of, you know, maybe just not say that part, or it would be okay ending an episode on a kind of subtler note, less so than, you know, Lost, which really kind of ends each episode on kind of a, wait, what was that? Or what's going to happen next kind of mm-hmm. moment. So
yeah.
You can definitely tell that it was a more stratified era when these shows came out, where there wasn't as much blurring between, you know, calibers of TV, so to speak.
I love it. All right. So my last question to you, given that you are completely spoiler free, or largely spoiler free, it's hard because things just seep into the pop culture groundwater, you know, but like, Saeed aside, is there any character or any question or any particular story that you're most excited to learn more about going forward?
Much like you, I am in the bag for Jaime Lannister, which transitively means like I'm really into Sawyer. Even to the point where his hair moves in the same way and the same shitty smiles, like, and I don't know what it says about me with my, you know, eye on representation, but the problematic white guy, the one who's, I think calls Saeed Al Jazeera or Abdul or whatever. And that's a whole other conversation. I don't want to open that up, but like, I think Sawyer is definitely someone who's complicated or at least interesting enough to me that I really want to see what happens with him. Especially with the twist on the letter, which I did not see that coming personally, but, you know, I think that one sticks out and, Sun and Jin, just because I know a lot of times, other Asians, Asian Americans, I'm not entirely sure. I think they're just supposed to be Korean, right?
Yeah.
They're not fleshed out. It's very similar to how it is with me and, you know, South Asians. Like, we don't get a lot of prominence because there are other minority groups that kind of hold the pop culture attention more, whether it's, you know, African Americans or Middle Eastern people. You don't see a lot of singular focus on, like, say, Korean specifically. Often they're just kind of lumped into a broader Asian model of character. So I'm very interested to see what happens with them. So, that's kind of what I'm interested in. But for the most part, I kind of really like where everyone's going. I think you guys talked about how having Hurley actually push back on some of the fat phobicness of some of the other characters was something that was refreshing to see even now.
Yeah.
Just because we still really treat people, you know, we kind of have the singular idea of what an actor or a character in a story should look like. And when they're outside of that, we kind of let them be the butt of a lot of jokes and no real pushback to that. So in general, I really like where they're going with most of these characters. So I'm kind of in it for all of them, but those were kind of the specific ones that stood out to me so far.
Excellent. Well, the conspicuous absence of Jack is noted. And no, I'm just kidding. we will figure it all out as we go forward. Thank you so much for watching several episodes of Lost just so I can have this conversation with you. And I'm excited that you will, be continuing to watch it going forward.
Yeah. No, I'm absolutely, all in on this now. So. So much for a TV-free summer, but I don't think that's possible anyway. So
this is it's island watching. It's good summer watching. Where can people find you and all of your incredible thoughts and puns, Manu Mishra?
Yeah. So I am Manu at Manuclear Bomb on basically any social media. My Twitter is full of all sorts of things from pop culture to politics. So please go at your own, you know, whatever you're comfortable with. My Instagram is almost exclusively cats. My cat Gendry, who's currently sleeping on my foot right now. You can check that out. That's definitely a safe space. I have a Game of Thrones podcast called Scene of Ice and Fire, where we go through, Game of Thrones kind of one scene at a time. We kind of lump them together for the purposes of episodes, but it's a very granular look. If you're into the show or doing a rewatch, it's a great companion piece. And I am nothing set yet, but I'm working on something to do with, the Marvel films, not just the MCU, but all of comic book films, working on getting a podcast off the ground with that. So there'll be more of that coming on my on my Twitter feed and elsewhere as well. So be on the lookout for that.
Keep your eye on this spot. All right. Well, thank you, Manu, so much. I will see you soon at Con of Thrones.
Woo!
See you probably in the Slack before that.
And it's time to do that thing we're never going to stop doing. It's thanking our small council members. If you go to patreon.com/StarWorldSpoilers, you can join our small council. It's a Game of Thrones reference thing. And get a whole bunch of bonus stuff, including your name read on the podcast. Thank you very much, Stuart Wynn, Leah Rock, Nicholas Ng, Elizabeth Hines, Fiona McLaughlin, Nikki Jones, Liz Roller, Rosio, Billy Bosky, James Cooper,
Tyler Hannon, Kurt Klein, Vanessa Marshall, Corey Hilsey, Kelly Grady, Amy Reichert, Fanny Martin, Patrick Sullivan, Zachary Silverman, and Grace Richardson. Thank you very much.
I would like to thank Joshua Lane, Bethany Townsend, Danielle, Justin Young, I know how this one goes. Tasia? I think it's Tasia. Tasia Pender, Hannah Watkins, Chris Saunders, Danielle Bultema, Adam Wells, Louise Collins, Michael Filippini, Natalie Muskin Press, Brianne Polito, Tommy Fitzgerald, Dan Cleland, Michael Belitsky, Lindsay Romaine, Paul Terrell, Dre, and James Heath. Thank you guys so much.
And I would like to thank the following humans: Christopher McGrain, Sean Stringfields, Stephen Weathers, Warpstone, Derek Bachman, Marcus Masciarelli, Samba Muteba, Ajax, Greg Jagger, Luigi Oswego, Nathan Bodner, Stephanie Hoffman, Victoria Stout, Lawrence Agleton, Jeff Ziegler, Connor Mufich. Okay, I'm going with it. Amy H., Kate Dilligan, Stacy Taxon, and Debbie DeNice. Thank you all for being part of the Small Council.
And we're back to talk about the storm for Solitary. First, I want to say Locke is still the villain.
He's definitely doing some villainy shit in this one.
Has there been a character in television given a child a knife and you're like, yes, this is the right thing to do in this
obviously
situation.
The hero of this story.
Uh-huh. This is the guy who is going to be keeping us around. First of all, he hit Saeed on the head, drove him off anyway. So he's sort of, as we discussed previously, shadow villain for Saeed's whole side arc. But even back in the camp, being creepy.
I will say this. When it finally comes to a head with Michael learning about Walt throwing knives very accurately, Locke's argument for why Walt should learn how to do this is pretty strong.
I agree.
Like, he makes a good argument,
I want to learn how to throw knives if I were a child on an island and, like, there were boars and fucking polar bears.
it's another thing the show does to, like, separate the people who want off the island and the people who are totally cool with being on the island, which is, like, Michael and Locke are the polar opposites on this, which is Locke's chill. He's like, I'll hunt boar, I'll teach everybody how to do knife stuff. We're good here. Michael's like, I need to get my son off this goddamn island right now.
Yep. Point number two. Who in this series that wants to keep Walt on the island ends up being a good guy?
No, Walt himself wants to stay on the island.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so Walt.
Which I feel like is a fairly important one in this context.
Let's respect the boy's wishes. He wants to stay on the island.
Fine.
He's very special.
I'm gonna die on this hill, but I don't think I'm dead yet.
I will move your body into a cave, and I will put one black stone and one white stone in your pocket.
Right next to me will be my other body from You Can't Make a Fellowship of the Rings adaptation without Tom Bombadil Hill.
And together we'll be...
I mean, I think... The stuff that Locke is doing in season one is part of the growing argument that he's maybe the villain or the chief antagonist.
I'm fine with chief antagonist, but every time I see Locke look like I'm special and the island is something special for me, and this is like, I just feel nothing but empathy for him. I think Locke is so sad. It makes me sad what happens to Locke. So I don't like calling him a villain. I like calling him an antagonist. He gets like, he thinks he thinks that what is happening to him is magical and everything is in service of the island, which is magical, but not in a, like, I want to end the world kind of way. Like, I genuinely think he does care about other people. I think he does care about Claire. He cares about Claire's baby eventually, like, all this stuff. I think he does actually care. It's not just about, like, sneakily, creepily forming alliances and stuff like that. And I think he genuinely is teaching Walt how to defend himself. And also he's spending time with Walt, which Michael refuses to do. So I'm pushing back on your Locke nonsense.
Another point. Who does Locke bring into the camp this episode? Neil?
Ethan?
It's not Locke's fault.
In well, yeah, that's true.
Ethan, that Locke's fault?
Ethan sneaks up on everyone except for the people who just watched the episode we're watching. Because let me tell you something about William Mapother, cousin to Tom Cruise. He sticks out like a sore thumb in this episode.
Yeah.
Like, really there's does. Just.
Well, I think they introduced. Like, I think they introduced Hive Guy at the same time, so you aren't like, who's this well, but Hive new guy? You're like two new guys. It's fun.
Well, like Hive Guy, I feel like I may have seen in the background somewhere, but they like. He goes a little too hard with being weird. Like, so in this first scene.
Yeah, I also know how to hunt really good. Right. Like, you haven't seen me until now.
He's just like too weird to not have stuck out previously. And I know it's because he wasn't cast, but like, if Ethan was with these people from the beginning.
Yeah, at least Goodwin was there from the start, you know?
Exactly. Well, and I guess we're meant to believe that Ethan was kind of there from the start, just like Goodwin, but. Man, he really, like, it's so funny watching it again, and it's like, oh my god, he sticks out so badly as, like, someone who does not fit in with any of this.
I really, Nikki and Paulo, this one, well.
Yeah, but, and they do a good thing, because it's like, next episode, they figure it out.
But I think another thing about William Mapother is he's got this, like, once you know the Cruise thing, like, he's got this, just, it's this weird energy. I don't know what his stance on Xenu is, but, like, William Mapother is this, like, guy who, like, is just way more ripped than you feel like he should be. That's how I feel about him. Every single shot, especially when Ethan is ever in the rain and his polo is just, like, weirdly clinging to his very large arms, and you're like, why does this guy have so many muscles? Like, I don't feel like this should be a guy with so many muscles. I don't know if that's a weird thing to say. I'm not even talking about it from like a hunk watch perspective. I'm just sort of like, he freaks me out, and I think that's, you know, intentional, but you're right that like some guy who just like freaks you out on principle does not blend well for a mole into, you know, this crash site. So
why did nobody ask Ethan to help dig out Jack from the rock pile? He's ripped.
He has so many muscles.
Kate had to get in there and digs really hard.
She
Ethan could have just tossed all that aside.
She also has a lot of muscles. It's okay.
She does have a lot of muscles.
Where's Ethan been? Is the question. So, also, how is it that, like, no one... Wait, so, who does he meet? He meets Charlie? Right? He meets Ethan. Who's in that first scene with Ethan? Why can't I remember this?
I think it's Jack, right? Because they find extra bags. So right. It's Jack and Hurley that they roll up to. Because Hurley looks down in the bags.
Yeah,
and
okay. So, and Hurley acts like he's never met this dude before. Kind of. I'm just saying. Like, how is there a person on this island that Hurley doesn't know? Because he was in charge of the food at the beginning.
He would react the same if, like, freaking rugby shirt girl rolled up to him. He'd be like,
yeah, I guess that's true.
Hey, rugby shirt girl.
Well, here's the people that would know, maybe. Claire, because she did, like, the memorial thing.
Right.
And I think that's it, right?
Hurley, because he was distributing the food at the beginning.
Yes, but he would have been
theory,
there by
yeah,
now.
Yeah, in theory, Ethan was there from the start. So.
Mm. All right.
But just in terms of, like, who would have been on the passage, because that's eventually how Hurley finds him out.
Like, I wish I could go back into the Calm and ask the Calm people without somehow spoiling it. What's your read on Ethan right now?
Oh, I think you tipped your hat to that. You're like, and we meet a guy named Ethan. That's all we'll say for now.
But I just, I'm curious whether people are picking that up.
It's
who
a challenge.
Have not seen it.
It's a challenge to them every time. Like, when Arntz shows up at the end of this season, as I said, like, Diana and I just watched the end of season one. Diana knows nothing. She was shocked when Walt was taken. But,
we want the boy.
She that's actually, like the boy.
She made me spoil for her. She's like, tell me what happens to Walt because I don't want to watch this if some kid dies. So I had to tell her what happens to Walt. But
yeah, we were like, did you tell him?
You could have just said like Walt doesn't die.
I did say that. I said he doesn't die.
What's the fun? Because Diana can't escape. She's you're there. Well, that was such an empty threat. You could have. Okay, I guess I'm more mean. But continue.
Anyway, when Arch shows up at the end of the season, she's like, oh, hey, guy who's definitely going to die, like, very soon.
Oh, so now you know what red shirts are. There you go.
Lost figured out how to do those.
Yeah, so, but Ethan's not, I mean, even though he's actually literally wearing a burgundy polo, right? It's fun because, like, maybe people think he's a red shirt. Maybe they think he's like, oh, here's some guy. Oh, they've just conveniently introduced who they're definitely going to kill.
His energy is too big, though.
So big.
I think.
Yeah. And also, we're not...
Too much too fast.
Big shirt energy.
Does anybody remember when the actual red shirts conversation happens? Because Boone brings it up to Locke. Why do I remember that?
Yeah, it happened.
I think later in season one.
Later.
Yeah.
Later.
Yeah.
All right. Oh, wait, because he's ripping up a red shirt or something, and that hasn't even happened yet. All right, cool. Speaking about things that are happening later in the season, I'm pretty sure we got through the calm without any beeps, but if we did, it's because it was very hard for me to not gender Alex whenever
you were the only person who talked about her, so you were like,
right.
The child, Alex.
She knows how to ask for Alex in 6 different languages.
Yeah. Wo ist Alex?
I think we did okay. This is our first, you know, our first mention of the others, and then obviously our first Alex drop. And then the other thing is the cable is like kind of left off until the end of season 3, right?
Yeah.
We don't even deal with the cable anymore.
The looking
everything's just
yeah, I love how they
dramatic.
Just leave that there. Like, well, no one ever asks any more questions. Well, I guess they assume that it's like running to Russo's thing.
Yeah, whatever. It's not that big of a spoiler, but like, I don't think it's, when you were like, doesn't look like anything's powered in Russo's thing. I mean, like, I think people watching would be like, oh, I assume that Gable goes to Russo somehow because she has a transmission, even though that transmission is not coming from that place. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think they didn't even know where the cable was going to go, I think, I would guess.
Right.
That it's going to go into the ocean.
Well, doesn't she say something like the others control the transmission thing or something?
Right. It's in like, well, and they haven't introduced the dark territory concept yet, but she alludes to it by saying like, that's where, you know, they control it now.
Yeah.
So I guess that would mean that he could have been trapped by other, anyway, the whole, others, whispers, Russo timeline here is muddied and then later sort of just like written off as being alone for too long.
Someone,
like it's written off here, I guess.
Someone wrote in and I forget if it was like a comment on our Slack or whatever. They were like, how mean of the island to leave Russo that alone that long without even any like fun ghosts to keep her company? Like, she doesn't get to hang out with any others, which not that she wanted to, but like they didn't even try. Like, ever? She just killed, like, her expedition and then, like, never saw anyone again? Robert
it
just
is
visit
interesting.
Her as a ghost? Like, why not? You know? So, that's weird.
Well, it's also very weird to me, and let's see, one of my rewatch tracks, I'm in, like, early season 3, but it just never feels like they tie up, like, why were they leaving Russo alone?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Like when we eventually learn about the intricate workings of the many different kinds of people who are on this island, how no one ever stumbled upon Russo is a very weird question to me.
Well, I think it's all right. Let me try to dig back in my brain. Ben steals Alex because he's supposed to kill Russo. She's on like a fake list, Man in Black faking Jacob list. But he sees the baby and decides to take the baby and then warns her off ever engaging with the others, I think is how the show explains it. But you're right in the sense that at this point, knowing what we know about the island, it makes no sense that she would be solitary and not know like tons about the monster, which she later like talks about it as like a pillar of black smoke that means children are going to come.
Security system for the island.
Security system. Well, then they retcon that because she's been to the temple before and she doesn't, you know, trust apparitions or anything, because I guess that's what she thought the sickness was, because they hear the smoke monster yelling inside the temple.
I gotta say, I find the sickness to be one of the most confusing and possibly misguided things that the show does, because it's so nebulous, and like the way in which it affects different people is so different. You know what I mean? Like I don't get angry about like various Lost lore that's introduced later in the series. I don't mind. It's just when they like try to like, no, the sickness makes sense all the way through, and I'm like, does it? Claire somehow like breaks the spell of the sickness and like theoretically goes off and raises Aaron, but like Saeed is sick forever, and so he commits suicide. Like, it's just, I don't really understand all of that. Anyway, point being, I when you see Russo, when there's the time hop and Jin meets Russo, like hops through Russo's origin story, that's a fun thing to do. And it, you know, she makes a mention later in the season about like, oh, and that's where so-and-so lost his arm, and then you see that person lose his arm in the final season, and you see why she killed Robert and stuff like that. But like, it just feels a little like to connect the dots for me. That being said, I love Russo as a character, and I love when Russo shows up, and just like emerges out of, sometimes she just like emerges and then she'll just like leave them. She's like, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's how she comes with Ben, I think, like later on. She's just like, this guy lies a lot and then leaves.
And then she's like, bye bye.
You take care of him.
Yeah.
She has really good, I'm trying to come up with a term for it. She's really good, like, well, a term that's not offensive to people. But she has like the way her eyes, like she has these very active eyes, and
like you could just sort of thing.
Yeah. Like a manic sort of thing. Yeah. And she does, that actress has this just great manic facial expression range that I think sells, especially in this episode, sells that she's been alone for way too long.
I completely agree. She also, I thought you were trying to inoffensively say something like manic. I understand that now. I thought you were trying to say Irish goodbye without offending the Irish. And I'm like, I love it. but nobody knows how to Irish goodbye out of an away missing like Russo.
No, you know, people use the phrase crazy eyes.
No, I know. Yeah, I know what you were trying to avoid saying. Okay, here's my favorite Russo fact that we learned on Lostpedia, which is that in the original script, Russo tells Saeed that she was part of a research team, and when Saeed asks her what they were researching, she says time.
Yeah, that's what I was alluding to in the call.
Which rules. That would have been such a cool moment. And ABC's like, can you pump the brakes on the sci-fi thing? We don't love that. So make it science or whatever it is she says.
Do more about the sickness.
Yeah, do more about the sickness. And I mean, it's true. Like, you know, when we were watching, and I'm sorry I keep bringing up Diana, but it's just like, it's fun to watch Lost through a first timer's eyes. When the smoke monster shows up at the end of season one, Diana's like, okay, that's when the show is like crazy. You know what I mean? Because like, I mean, I guess like roaring and something, you know, up in the sky that people are staring up at off screen, that is like sort of sci-fi-y, but like maybe it's a dinosaur, and a dinosaur is like kind of sci-fi, but like, you know, we could deal with that. Or, I mean, or a robot.
It's not like, dissimilar from when dragons show up the first time on Game of Thrones.
Yeah, but like when a fucking soot sprite makes its way out of the forest, you're like, I'm sorry, what?
It's like, I thought this was one kind of show, but it's a different kind of show.
I just so wish that Russo, who like Claire is inexplicably traveling on choppy waters, very pregnant, was a time researcher. That would have ruled. So I'm sorry that ABC made them cut that.
Yeah. And then we have whispers, which are another thing on the island that isn't necessarily adequately explained, I don't think, in the entire series, but works really well here, getting us into the whole others concept. And then according to the description on Lostpedia of the episode, the monster, it can also be heard vaguely at the end. So just sort of tying all those things together into paranoid islandness. I don't know. This also comes together with like, dripping wet, shushing Walt in like weird things the jungle does that I don't understand, because I can't necessarily attribute it to one of our battling god forces. Does anybody remember feeling better about the whispers by the time the show ended.
Apparently it's like the trapped, yeah, it's the trapped dead. I think, right? Like, I'm sorry if you just said this, but like Michael says, like, it's people who died on the island who have like unfinished business. So Michael is a whisperer eventually, I guess.
Still don't feel great about that, but okay. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool story, bro. I mean, let's tie it back into our, like, our listener written in grand theory that the smoke monster is actually like a fraction of the light that doesn't know what it is. Maybe the light could reflect dead people. It has the same power. Its problem is it just doesn't confuse its own identity with the dead people. It didn't take on any trauma. It just channels people. Does that make me feel better? I don't know. That's the excuse I would give if someone asked me why I wrote it. Talking out of my ass, so maybe we'll just let that go until we get more whisper evidence. I do remember, though, it feeding in a lot more to when we do get the idea of dark territory. There's that scene where all the torches light up around Jack. At that point in the mythology, I'm like, yes, whispers are people, but then it continues to spin out to be weirder with visions and whatnot. But not here. Not here. It's used as an effective cliffhanger tactic. Then we got one more note here in the storm section.
Oh,
Nadia's
yeah.
note says, Nadia's... you'll see me in the next life, if not this one, brother.
Yeah, she kind of uses Desmond's quote before Desmond does. So there you go.
It's a lot of misconnections in this show.
Oh, yeah, and then Saeed's lie that Nadia's dead because she's not dead, right? Okay, cool.
Right, and he knows it by the time he's on the island.
Right.
But, like, does the show know it?
Probably not, because the show wanted... The reason that Solitary's next to Confidence Man is because the show wants us to think that torturing Sawyer brought back the fact that he, like, tortured his love to death and sort of make that more of a serialized narrative. I mean, they can't super serialize it. That's why you get forlornly looking at the photo and on the beach.
It almost seems like they want to make it like, this is why Saeed gave up all the torture. And this is why it was a big deal that he tortured Sawyer last week, because he went down this extremely dark path and was like, no more torture.
Yeah. And then I think that connects these two episodes. I don't see like a ton of foreshadowing for the Claire episode outside of Ethan showing up, but Claire's not even in this episode, I don't think.
Well, because originally she's supposed to already kidnapped.
Oh yeah, that's right. Originally she's supposed to be already kidnapped. And they were going to be like, oh, you know, why not make a golf course? We're all tired of worrying about Claire and Charlie.
I will say that there is a lot of weird lightheartedness that comes in some of the episodes when Claire is gone, where, like, when I was watching with Diana, we were both just sitting there screaming, why is no one is looking for Claire? Nobody is looking for her at all.
Right. The only person freaking out about it is Charlie.
And he gets over it, not over it, but, like, he moves on to do other things fairly quickly, so... Yeah. poor Claire. Nobody cares.
Claire.
There's probably something you said also about, like a traumatic state if you're living where you're like, everybody who gets taken by mysterious people into the jungle could still be alive. That doesn't seem like a healthy way to think about things either. But you're right. She is a pregnant girl. It's probably very cold hearted.
I mean, not that it's cold hearted. I just feel like, I don't know. No one really looks for her, like, really beyond like the first effort, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Anyway, we'll talk about
that. I think it's weird because the rest of the camp sort of thinks John is out there looking for her.
Oh,
and he gives up pretty quickly.
Yeah.
All right. Do we have anything else to say about Solitary before we wrap it up for the week?
No, just that, like, Saeed saying the word Danielle is like one of my top 10 lost sounds. I don't know. I just love that he, like, Danielle. Everyone calls her Rousseau, except for Saeed and maybe Ben. That seems like something Ben would do. Call her Danielle, yeah. That creep. But I love Ben, but he stole her baby, so I don't know. But yeah, Danielle. It's a beautiful, beautiful plummy thing to say.
Neil, anything, any last thoughts? Danielle.
No, just a great Hurley episode. Most episodes that involve Hurley are great Hurley episodes. So there you go.
Yeah, I like this episode. We're getting closer to the mythology, closer to the stuff I really want to dig my teeth into. So Neil, where are we up to next week?
Oh, well, next week we are going to be with episode 10, Raised by Another. It's a Claire episode.
Claire. I don't know what that turned Claire. Into at the end.
Claire.
Claire.
Yeah.
Cool. So Claire's going to be having some nightmares.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Until next week, where can people find your work online? Let's start with Joanna Robinson.
You can find me on VanityFair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Jarothis.
And Neil Miller?
Well, you know, you can always get me at FilmSchoolRejects.com or on Twitter at Rejects. But don't forget, new website, StormPodcast.com. New email address, hosts@StormPodcast.com. New Twitter handle, @StormPodcast. That's where you can find our stuff.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E, on the Fighting in the War Room podcast, and urging you not to fall down because there are snare traps in the jungle. It's hard. And then you'll get conked on the back of the head for like the second time in 4 days.
It's double concussion. It's bad.
It's bad.
And the knees.